Jordan is in her third week of an Asian tour, mostly in Singapore. And so we're continuing with some reviews of volume four, Following in the Buddha's Footsteps. And so we also have six new guests who have arrived to participate in the first month of retreat with us. So they're just arriving tonight. So this might be a good kickoff for the retreat, talking about the higher training and ethical conduct. And so far, we've, in Venerable's absence, we've had the chance to review the eight qualities of the Buddha jewel, the Dharma jewel, and the Sangha jewel with Venerable Jigme. And then last week, we looked at the beautiful qualities of the Buddha, in particular, looking at the four fearlessnesses and the 10 powers, 18 unshared qualities, beautiful things to review and go over and be inspired by. And so that really sets the stage now for looking at ethical conduct. Because as we'll see, the higher training in ethics, concentration, and wisdom are distinguished from just regular trainings because they're done with refuge in the three jewels. So it's interesting to look at the order in which Venerable Chodron has organized this library of wisdom and compassion. At least it is for me. And I like to try to figure out why this order. His Holiness gave her carte blanche to organize it in the way she thought it would make most sense for a Western audience. And so it's interesting to think about why the topics come in the order that they do. And of course, we can ask her directly when she's back. But in the meantime, we can guess. Okay, so we'll start with some prayers, and then we'll have just a few minutes of silent meditation, and then I'll set the motivation and we'll go from there. So before we take refuge, we just take a moment to visualize the refuge field and cultivate the appropriate thoughts in our mind. In the Spokane class, the last several weeks, we've been talking about Buddha nature and precious human rebirth. And although it's true that we're currently caught in cyclic existence, we're subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, and various problems, it's also true that we have a marvelous, precious human rebirth right now, with all the freedoms and fortunes and the opportunity to really make use of the conditions that we have by devoting ourselves studying the Dharma. And we also have Buddha nature, the two types of Buddha nature, which allow us to make the best use of this precious human rebirth. So each morning, we train to wake up with the three powerful aspirations that give direction to our lives, to our actions. Today, as much as possible, may I not harm a single sentient being, including myself, as much as possible. And today, as much as possible, may I benefit others with my body, speech, and mind. And may bodhicitta guide all my actions with an awareness of dependent arising and emptiness too. And so with every new action we do, whether it's mundane or spiritual, religious, we can bring the power of our bodhicitta aspiration so that each action can actually become a cause, a seed on our mind stream that will bring about full awakening one day. And in addition to that, we're so fortunate that we have this genre of teachings called mind training, so that we have so many tools at our fingertips to transform whatever adversity comes our way, transforming it into a support for our Dharma practice and steering our mind in a virtuous way. So how can we go wrong? We've got so many excellent causes and conditions for us right now. So please take a moment to refresh the bodhicitta motivation that you cultivated this morning, so that our time together tonight also becomes time well spent in both the short and the long term. was doing so well. The cough was going away, and then I got exposed to some very strong air freshener that brought it all back. So, luckily we have cough drops. Okay, go ahead and put up the first slide, if you would, just to brighten our minds. And hopefully we'll have the link soon for people online, if it's possible. Thank you. All right. So in light of looking at the higher training of ethics tonight, I thought it might be helpful to begin by asking the Abbey community a question in particular, because we've just come out of an incredibly busy period of activity at the Abbey, getting the Buddha Hall up and running, and the AV system installed, and the artwork hung, the Buddha statues painted and filled, and troubleshooting the various systems in the building. So we've been very busy, as well as hosting some quite large retreats for the Abbey. So I'm wondering, during that period of time, what did you learn about yourself during this extended, demanding time? And what important lessons do you intend to carry forward? I'm hoping this can be an additional way that we can turn the corner, you know, by thinking about what we've just been through and how we might do things differently in the future. So what did you come up with? It's not on the screen. Venmo something.
I'm going to start with what I learned by watching Venerable Thupten Children, because she's not in the room to ask me to stop. So when your mind is imbued with virtue, you don't run out of gas. Mm-hmm. In the same way that I run out of gas. And I just noticed that she was absolutely in a joyful mode as she was directing where everything was going to be placed and hung and moved to and grabbing whoever she could find. And pretty soon I heard that people were trying to hide from her because they knew that she would grab them to help her put up more holy images. And this went on for, a few weeks. Mm-hmm. And then the teachings happened. And just to see that she was always vibrant and not looking bedraggled and worn out and all of that. In addition to that, she's writing books, she's an abbess, she's guiding all of us and the guests and answering emails. And so that's something that really is inspiring for my mind. I think at the same time, we all found that we had the capacity to do more than we thought we could do. Now, I think we all got a little bit tired, but I think I have the habit of saying that I'm tired before I'm really tired, or I think I'm tired, but anyway, there's some self-talk that I do that I do know how to push the edge, but there's something I'm not figuring out here quite in this moment. But I think we have more capacity in general than we think we do when we're engaged in virtue. That's all for now.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I found something similar, which is I thought I was giving 100%, but then I found that I could give more. And so then I realized I hadn't been giving 100%. And also, coming back to motivation, that's really the key that keeps us from getting distressed overtired, overly tired, or that mental talk, feeling personal distress, whatever it might be. What about others? Venerable Deki.
I mean, this is right along the lines with what Venerable Sumpton was saying, but the huge difference at the beginning of the Vinaya course, I'm thinking specifically, I was filled with so much joyous effort and just like, wow, I can just go and just keep doing things and just feeling so enthusiastic and just, just incredibly joyful about helping whatever needed. And then as that faded and then just seeing the critical judgmental mind just sucks the energy out so quickly. And so it was just very striking, the contrast between the two mind states. And it was just a mind state. So
mm-hmm. No. Merely a thought.
No.
That really impacts us. Thank you. Who else? Venerable.
I learned that I can become very inspired by seeing others in terms of how much they're able to do and to hold. I mean, just to see so many of the monastics here, who, especially those who are attending to the luminary nuns, and they were just doing so much all the time, and then to witness the luminary nuns serving their teacher and doing so much. That uplifts my mind. Mm-hmm. And right along with what people are saying, just I could see that my body could do way more than my mind sometimes would give it credit for. And I also, one of the things I also learned was that I have a tendency to push through fatigue or sickness and keep working and offering service even when I know I'm getting sick. And to not pay attention to what's happening in my body. And so I want to pay attention more and to take rest when needed.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a wise kind of, I don't think I'd use the word pushing, but there's an energy behind working hard. And then there's pushing. Pushing has kind of a negative element to it, doesn't it? It's more like, what's the real motivation there? Yeah, so coming back to motivation is really important. Anyone else? Okay, thank you. All right, so tonight I'd like to start by talking about the Lam Rim. In a traditional Lam Rim outline, you know I like outlines. In a traditional Lam Rim outline, where would we find the higher training in ethical conduct? Which scope would it be part of? Middle scope. Yeah. Typically, the middle scope presents, thank you, the first two noble truths, true dukkha and true origin of dukkha, as well as the 12 links. And these are used to develop the mind state that we might call renunciation or the determination to emerge from samsara. And so we renounce dukkha of cyclic existence, and we're determined to attain liberation from karma and afflictions. And so we covered the first two truths extensively in volume 3, as well as Buddha nature. Now, this sequence is quite logical because, I mean, actually the Buddha nature is not usually presented as part of the Lam Rim. But the sequence is quite logical because we need to understand our situation in samsara before we actually have this energy to want to emerge. So we look at true suffering, true origin of suffering, like in Safe 2, the Safe class. And so we look at the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, the first two Noble Truths. We look at the 8, the 6, the 3. There are many ways to meditate on that suffering or dukkha. And then studying the 12 links also supports our renunciation because we see how we get into the situation. But it also supports the next two truths because in the reverse order, it shows how we can get out of this situation as well. So the 12 links have kind of a dual role. But in volume 3, we also came to know about our potential, the study of Buddha nature, which, yeah, is not, you just don't typically find that in the Lam Rim. So having studied the first two truths, we would naturally turn to the second set of truths, true cessation and true paths. And true paths are the cause that lead to the true cessations. And because the Lam Rim is presented from a Mahayana point of view, the middle scope usually doesn't include much about true cessations and true paths. That's saved for the great scope and the perfections. It does include teachings on the higher training in ethical conduct. But the Library of Wisdom and Compassion, being a unique presentation of Lam Rim topics for a Western audience, dives right into the three higher trainings, and with some very interesting content. So ethics, concentration, and wisdom are found in both the middle scope and the great scope, but they're distinguished by the motivation and the goal being sought. So renunciation, which leads to liberation, one practices the three higher trainings. Renunciation is the motivation, the goal is liberation. Bodhicitta, one practices the six perfections with the bodhicitta aspiration, and that leads to full awakening. So both goals rely on developing true paths, what we call true paths. And true paths leading to liberation can be subsumed in the three higher trainings, the first of which is the higher training of ethical conduct. So in slide three, His Holiness and Venerable Trodron write, "The Buddha attained awakening by practicing step by step. While meditating under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha gained the wisdom that broke through samsara and led to nirvana. He cultivated his wisdom based on having attained deep states of concentration while meditating for 6 years with five ascetic companions. He developed concentration based on abiding in ethical conduct by leaving the householder's life and becoming a renunciate." So here in the Buddha's life story, the three higher trainings shine as a beacon on the path. His own life story demonstrates how the three higher trainings lead to liberation, or we could say full awakening or non-abiding nirvana. So most spiritual paths contain some practice in ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. But as followers of the Buddha, we refer to ours as the three higher trainings. So before you put up the next slide, just see if you can check in your own mind, what is it that distinguishes these practices as higher trainings? So as followers of the Buddha, we refer to ours as three higher trainings. These practices are higher in three ways. They're done with refuge in the three jewels, indicating that they are higher than those of non-Buddhists. They are infused with the understanding of selflessness, showing that they lead to the higher aim of eradicating ignorance, and that's quite unique to the Buddhist tradition, isn't it? And they're done with the aspiration for liberation or full awakening, making them higher than doing them to attain a fortunate rebirth. So, done with the motivation of the determination to be free or bodhicitta, this would exclude people who are just aiming for a good rebirth or practitioners who are wishing to attain the mundane form and formless realm absorptions, which we've been talking about when Venerable's been teaching. Okay. Then there's also a scriptural source for the Buddha spelling out the three higher trainings. He says the Digha Nikaya, the chapter on Subha, Ananda affirmed that the Buddha continuously emphasized the importance of the three higher trainings. Subha, there are three divisions of things which the Lord praised and with which he aroused, exhorted, and established people. Which three? The divisions of Aryan ethical conduct, the division of Aryan concentration, and the division of Aryan wisdom. And, you know, this may leave a question in your mind, like Arya paths are typically beings who have already developed some a direct realization of emptiness, right? So that could be on the middle scope, the Shravaka path, or it could also be on the Bodhisattva path. So how many of you have either taken a safe six course or facilitated one? Most of us. Okay, so in the next slide, you'll probably recognize this is an exercise that we give the students in that training. And if you haven't done that one yet, it's probably coming. So here we have the Four Noble Truths, and then the fourth truth, true paths, can be divided into the higher training in ethics, higher training in concentration, and the higher training in wisdom. And then each of those are further divided into the Eightfold Noble Path, which we don't talk a lot about in the Tibetan tradition. Mostly you find teachings on that from the Pali Canon, but Venerable likes to talk about them, and Safe Six talks about them quite a bit. And we can take them on. Actually, in the Tibetan tradition, they're talked about in a different context as things that are practiced on the path once a person has attained the path of accumulation, a bodhisattva's path of accumulation. But in the Pali tradition, they're talked about more as things that all of us can practice right now. Okay, so that's the first section on kind of identifying the three higher trainings. Then the second section is called The Importance of Ethical Conduct. And I found this inspiring to go back and read again. So Venerable and His Holiness write, "People who are serious about religious practice differ from those who are not. Buddhists accept that human life has a deeper purpose than sensual enjoyments, wealth, power, social status, and praise gained in this life, and that a fortunate rebirth, liberation, and awakening are valuable in the long term." So this is part of our precious human rebirth, right? To really think about how we have this larger purpose that we can attain with this life. We're not just looking for the pleasures of this life. So Dharma practice begins when we look beyond the pleasures of this life, such as, you know, the eight worldly concerns. And what makes a precious human rebirth so valuable is it's the perfect basis for developing liberation and full awakening. And also, as I mentioned in the motivation, you know, and we find in talking about precious human rebirth, it's also the perfect basis for making use of everything that happens in our life. Every single thing, whether it's, you know, like stressful periods of time where you have to work really hard, or problems, maybe meeting with difficult people, or even societal challenges like we're facing right now in this country and worldwide, actually, climate crisis and all the rest. So we have ways of working with those. That's part of the purpose and the meaning of this precious human life. So since afflictions prevent us from actualizing our spiritual purpose, we want to reduce and eventually eliminate them. And the various levels of ethical codes guide us to subdue our physical, verbal, and mental actions. So here, ethical code. Venerable likes to use these terms. Ethical codes refers to a set of precepts taken in the presence of a spiritual mentor. So probably all of us in this room have experienced that. And then precepts instead of vows. She doesn't like the word vow because it has connotations. We bring some baggage when we hear the word vow. It sounds like something that's very static and binding in a way. Whereas precepts are more like guidelines. They refer to the particular trainings set out in that ethical code that are more like guidelines that are like the guardrails that keep us in line, going in the direction that we have determined we already want to go. So, and we take these voluntarily. We're reminded of that regularly, because otherwise we can start railing against them as if someone has imposed this on it. But that's not the case. All along the path, each step we take, our own choice from on the basis of our own investigation and analysis of what's going to really help us progress along the path. And then the next slide. And then I love this picture. This is the fun of putting together a talk, is seeing which pictures inspire you that go with the text. And this one definitely inspires me. In fact, I put it on my iPad, and I look at it regularly to remind me not to waste time. So again, they write, "The meaning of mental advancement is that untamed states of mind decrease and beneficial states increase. For obscurations to be removed from the root by the wisdom realizing emptiness, our mind must first be capable of meditating with single-pointed concentration." Luckily, we'll have a chance to play with that and hone that in our upcoming retreat. And then to subdue the mental internal distractions that interfere with concentration, firm mindfulness and introspective awareness are necessary. So to strengthen our mindfulness and introspective awareness and to gain concentration, we must first overcome the grosser external distractions by developing mindfulness and introspection, introspective awareness of our physical and verbal actions. So this is done through the practice of the higher training of ethical conduct. That's why we're talking about this. So the higher training in ethical conduct involves keeping precepts. And to keep precepts, we must develop these faculties of mindfulness and introspective awareness. Taking precepts is easy, keeping them is not so easy. And in fact, the longer you keep precepts, the more you find the more difficult they are, I think. Well, maybe then there's a place where we begin to turn. Mindfulness, or remembering our precepts, is holding our mind throughout the day on how we want to speak and act. Again, it sounds so simple, doesn't it? So straightforward, and yet so challenging, at least for me. And also how we don't want to speak and act. And so, you know, we're in a process of learning. So that's mindfulness, is remembering our precepts. And then introspective awareness helps us to check up whether we're acting and speaking as we have intended to. So we then build on the coarse mindfulness that we, you know, begin in our practice with. We build on that coarse mindfulness and introspective awareness, developing more subtle levels of mindfulness and introspective awareness in the higher trainings of concentration and also the higher training in wisdom as well. So I thought to revisit these two mental factors. mindfulness has this very specific definition or description, characteristics that we find in the Tibetan tradition, or actually, no, this comes even before in mind and awareness, in the study of mind and awareness. So mindfulness is a mental factor of non-forgetfulness. In fact, mindfulness and memory or remembering come from the same root. It's non-forgetfulness with respect to a familiar object. So we've already determined what our object is going to be. Like, we start with precepts. We try to be mindful of our precepts throughout the day. And then we try to be mindful of something more subtle, like watching for the characteristics of different states of mind that we are wanting to cultivate or wanting to avoid giving rise to in our own mind. Its function is to prevent distraction to another object. So it has these three main components to it: non-forgetfulness with respect to a familiar object, and it prevents distraction. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? So this is what we're going to be cultivating in our retreat, looking at cultivating mindfulness on the object, whether that's our breath or the Buddha image or the White Tara image, but also mindfulness as we're cultivating the four immeasurables, and especially not just on the cushion, but especially in between the sessions on the cushion when we get up, that we don't just leave all that good mindfulness there in the meditation hall or the Buddha hall, but rather when we get up, we take that with us. So, you know, there's lots of teachings on the Buddha giving a lot of inspiration for being aware of the body, speech, and mind in all the different variations, like when we're walking, when we're sitting, when we're sleeping, when we're standing. That's not just for very ascetic people. That's for us, you know. So even as we're walking from here to there, we can, in a gentle way, not in a tight way at all. We don't want to make our minds tight. But in a very gentle way, we can hold that kind of mindfulness and awareness. Like, okay, I'm walking from the Buddha Hall down to get a cup of tea in Chenrezig Hall. I'm just going to be aware of how I'm walking. And I'm going to stay aware of what my mind goes to. And in that way, we're building up these coarser levels of mindfulness that will support us when we come to the more subtle levels. So that can be very helpful. Now, I haven't come across a definition of introspective awareness, but what we find in mind and awareness literature is a definition of non-introspective awareness. So by looking at that and seeing what those qualities are, then we can infer what we're trying to do by developing introspective awareness. And in fact, later in volume four, there's quite a bit of material on introspective mindfulness and introspective awareness. So non-introspective awareness is a mental factor that being an afflictive intelligence has made no or only a rough analysis of the object, we could say, and is not fully alert to the conduct of our body, speech, and mind, and thus causes us to become carelessly indifferent. Okay, so usually we talk about introspective awareness as like part of our mind that's a spy that's checking up to see if we're still on our object of mindfulness. But here it's talking about being fully alert to the conduct of our body, speech, and mind so that we are not careless, so that we're actually careful, or we could say conscientious of our actions throughout the day. And it wouldn't be an afflictive intelligence. It would be actually non-introspective awareness is an affliction that's associated with ignorance. So I would guess that introspective awareness would be associated with some kind of wisdom. Yeah. So I'm curious, what are the main things that get in your way of staying mindful and using introspective awareness throughout the day, whether we're in retreat or not in retreat, to check up on the activities of your body, speech, and mind, as well as protecting your precepts? What are some of the main things that get in your way? Besides mindlessness and non-introspective awareness. Yeah, Venerable Lamsa.
Being one step ahead of where my body and mind is. So my mind being at the next destination before my body's there, mm-hmm. or on the next task before my mind, or before I finish what I'm doing in that moment, mm-hmm. Being lost in thought, kind of thinking about what's coming as opposed to being with where I am. Mm-hmm.
That reminds me, I heard one teacher say, you know, the problem with being mindless is that we're not there to know that we're being mindless. Yeah, we're not there. We're not present. We're not on the object. What else? Yeah.
I can get task-oriented, so I'm more concerned about getting the task done rather than how I'm doing it and whether I've mm-hmm. set a good motivation. It's just, I want to get this done, so I'll do whatever I need to do to get it done. Mm-hmm. And then I'm totally mindless.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we don't have the basis to be doing the action with a lot of awareness and intention. Yeah, Mary Grace.
And I was thinking that the root cause of that is that it's a very firm attachment to the self-centeredness. That when I'm mindless, when I'm task-oriented, and when I'm driven, it's all about me.
That's a good point.
And it's very, very solid. And when I'm so, it's very solid. I mean, there's a solidness to that. Mm-hmm. And only when I'm willing to stop for a moment and realize that from whatever strategy to loosen the grip. And, of course, it continues to become solid throughout the day, but that's just me.
Well, no, it's not just you.
No, I mean, it's just the me, the solid sense, the mm-hmm. self-centeredness.
Yeah, that's a really good point to make, because as soon as there's self-centeredness, then there is this, it easily leads to attachment. I want it done my way. I want it done this way. I want it to suit me. All those different things that very easily lead to a lot of afflictions. So thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. What else? Yeah. You have another one? Mm-hmm.
Being triggered or having an affliction running and not trying to stuff it so that I can deal with what I want to do, but it's reverberating within me and I'm not really clear about what I'm doing because I'm kind of in the mode of like background trying to manage the affliction that's kind of coloring what I'm doing, and I'm kind of caught between trying to focus on the task, stuff the affliction, focus on the task, stuff the affliction, as opposed to like stopping, really addressing the affliction And then with mindfulness, moving on or doing what needs to be done to get my mind in a good state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very graphic multitasking, kind of multitasking, isn't it? Like managing what's happening up here or in the mind. Yeah. Not very pleasant either. I know it well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What else? The rest of you are very mindful all the time. Yeah, minimal.
Fear and anxiety makes my body just froze, or the mind can just go blank for that moment because there's so much fear, or there's the energy of rushing, or the anxiety. So the mind just blank out for a moment. So if you can catch it, it's like, oh, there is anxiety or there's fear running at the back. If not, it's like your body will just kind of shut down or just freezes. So mm-hmm. that's something that I caught it. Like, I kind of catch it, yeah.
Uh-huh. I don't know if this is helpful or not, but I know for myself, I've begun to recognize that when there's fear or anxiety running, that can go right back to self-centeredness. That's one of the key features of being self-centered, is it gives rise to a lot of fear. And the anxiety is, I'm afraid I'm not going to get what I want. Yeah. So that can be like a little flag in your mind to check. Or it has been helpful for me to think, okay, who am I thinking about here? And how can I broaden my perspective? Because right now it's really narrow. And that narrowness then prevents the mindfulness and introspective awareness and the larger perspective of what's going on for others. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Anything else we haven't touched on? Sounds like it basically, comes down to self-centeredness and afflictions.
Yeah. I think where attachment comes in too is just like there's something way more entertaining than watching my own action. Listening to that conversation, watching this is more beautiful, that's more exciting, oh, there's a tune. I mean, there's always something that's way more interesting than paying attention to what I should be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. That's kind of an ongoing thing.
Mm-hmm. Would you say 8 worldly concerns? Or is that overreaching?
Yeah, but mostly it's sense.
Attachment to sense stimuli. Yeah.
And also like a sense of time. Like when there's a time crunch, I feel rushed and my mindfulness goes way down. Whereas like on a flex day, time just feels very spacious. I can slow down and do things mindfully and deal with the afflictions as they arise better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I had one of those aha moments that Venerable Daiki talks about. The other day, Venerable was, it was a BBC she was giving. Someone had asked a question, how do you know you're making any headway or being successful with your practice of concentration? Now, that's not ethical conduct, but I think it applies here as well. And do you remember Venerable's reply? She said, for our practice to be successful, we have to practice the analytic meditations on the antidotes, making our mind more familiar with them to dispel hindrances. I don't know, somehow I just went, duh. Like working on the antidotes constantly, antidotes to attachment, antidotes to anger, antidotes to jealousy, pride, all of those things, just naturally clearing out our mind, purifying our mind, getting much more familiar with the antidotes and strengthening them is going to me, that sounds like that's the ethical cleaning of the mind that then allows the mind to settle naturally, more naturally, let's put it that way, in addition to our efforts to develop mindfulness and concentration, mindfulness and introspective awareness. So I have had a little mantra that I've said sometimes, which is, I can't afford to get angry. I can't afford the time. It takes too much time to get angry because then I have to do a lot of cleanup work and my mind is disturbed for quite a while after I get angry. I mean, I still get angry, of course. But when I can remind myself, I can't afford to do this right now. I have too many things I really want to put my mind on and accomplish. I think we could say the same things about attachment. I can't afford to get involved in a lot of objects of attachment. I only have, like for us in retreat, I only have these certain amount of days here to really make a deep dive into my practice. I can't afford to be distracted by all the interesting snacks on the snack shelf. You know, that's often where we go in retreat. Or, you know, another cup of tea, or, you know, running here and there, or doing the things that we think must be done, those of us who have offering service chores. Let's not waste this opportunity doing that. Okay, so the next slide. I love this. It's so clear. Ethical conduct means to refrain from doing harm. That's the slogan of Buddhism, non-harm. So, and ethics. There it is. Ethical conduct means to refrain from doing harm. Or actually, Geshe Taishi Tsering, my teacher in Australia, used to say the essence of ethical conduct is the intention to guard. Guarding what? Guarding our mind from non-virtue. And guarding our mind from non-virtue is really what it comes down to. So that's the same thing as refraining from harm. They go hand in hand. And this applies to all of us, monastics, lay practitioners, because we all need to refrain from harming ourselves and others to make progress, real progress on the path, and, you know, to contribute to the peace in the lives of those around us. And so, to this effect, then, the Buddha advised us to abandon the 10 destructive actions, and taking and keeping the various levels of ethical codes aids us in doing this, and points out even subtler non-virtuous actions to avoid. Now, I found this interesting to note that, at least up to now, nowhere in the Library of Wisdom and Compassion is there a description of the 10 non-virtues like you find in the typical Lamrim. Where? I think if you go back to the section on karma, I don't think it's there. I mean, there's a lot that's spelled out in that section on the sections on karma. But there wasn't a usual description of the 10 non-virtues. Now, they're sprinkled throughout the books, that's for sure. But I just found that interesting. I think it's because they're very clearly spelled out in a lot of the Lamrim literature. And so I think His Holiness and Venerable focused on things that are maybe not so commonly spelled out in the Lamrim. So in, the third volume, we looked at the 6 root afflictions and the 20 secondary afflictions, as well as, you know, these very specific things about karma. But the higher training in ethical conduct really is about abandoning the 10 non-virtues of body, I mean, the 3 non-virtues of body and the 4 non-virtues of speech specifically. So it's dealing with body and mind, physical and verbal actions in particular. And in addition to that, holding the different vows that we take. So in the next slide, Tibetan Buddhism contains 3 levels of ethical codes, parimoksha or individual liberation, bodhisattva and tantric ethical codes. So parimoksha ethical codes focus on abandoning doing harm through our body and speech. Then notice how the Bodhisattva ethical code emphasizes abandoning self-centeredness and regulates our mental activities, as well as, if you look at those vows, they also regulate physical and verbal activities, but principally focusing on the mental aspect. And then the Tantric ethical codes help us overcome even more subtle obscurations, another form of harmful mental activity. And so it's because these ethical codes become more and more subtle, then we take them in this order, and they build one upon the other. They support each other in that way. Okay, next slide. Now we're sitting in the room where this beautiful tanka is on, graces the front of the altar. But I wanted people at home to see it as well, because it's just so beautiful. This is Mahaprajapati giving ordination to a nun named Patakara, who was foremost in ethical conduct, right? So we can think of her during our retreat. She's our one of our role models, actually all of the early nuns. So they further write, His Holiness and Venerable, that precepts give form and focus to ethical conduct. Living in precepts makes us more aware of our physical, verbal, and mental activities. It brings rapid and strong accumulation of merit for every moment that we're not breaking them. Isn't that, precepts are like double coupon day, you know? Those of you who are old enough to remember what that means. We used to collect coupons. Anyway, you know that? You knew that. You're so young. It's an app on the phone now. Okay. But do you get double coupons someday? I guess you do. Anyway, for every moment that we are holding the precepts and not breaking them, we're accumulating merit. I remember one teacher saying, you know, we should wake up in the middle of the night and just, like, get so excited, like, I have precepts. I have precepts. Really, it's that, like, if we could hear ching-ching in the background all the time, ching-ching, we're accumulating merit all the time. And yet, you know, poor quality view obscures that for many of us, doesn't it? But we're doing something very virtuous all the time. We're holding precepts. I mean, as long as we're not breaking them. Okay, also, precepts also help us to purify destructive karma and stop the most harmful results. Yeah. Okay, so next slide, please. I thought this was interesting. Keeping the precepts, they write, keeping the precepts we have taken is the best sign of being a holy being. Okay, so everyone in this room who has precepts, think about yourself as being a holy being. If we want to do a meditation retreat but ignore ethical conduct in our daily lives, our priorities are confused. Okay, that's speaking to us right now as we get ready to start our retreat tomorrow. The foundation of any practice, especially Vajrayana, is ethical conduct. Without keeping the commitments and precepts we've taken, attaining realization is impossible. Thinking otherwise is a result of not understanding the essence of Dharma practice. We shouldn't cheat ourselves by ignoring ethical living. So we can make a copy of this, put it on our puja table for the retreat. Wouldn't it be great if we got to the end of the Vajrasattva retreat and we said, wow, I didn't break any of my ethical precepts the whole time. That'd be wonderful. Or I didn't harm anyone the whole time. I only benefited myself and others. We can do that. We can aspire for that. Although precepts have such benefits, a person has to feel comfortable taking them, they write, and be prepared to assume the responsibility of following them as best as possible. Some people are brave when it comes to taking precepts and commitments, thinking that it's their right, but cowardly, that sounds like His Holiness, but cowardly when it comes to keeping them. We should be the opposite and think well before taking precepts. Then we humbly request to receive them from our teachers and with joy keep them properly. For a long time, I used to say that I took my precepts from this person or that person. It's only since I've received the full ordination in Taiwan that I've started using that word. I have received precepts because it's such a privilege to receive these and hold these precepts. It's not like we're taking them. It's like we were fortunate enough to receive them from a valid precept holder. So we should really think about them. It's so precious. Yeah. Okay, so then there's a section about the pratimoksha ethical conduct, and I think everyone here is aware of the different types of pratimoksha or individual liberation ethical codes. You know, there's three for lay practitioners, the male and female novice, the five precepts for male and female lay practitioners, and the one-day precepts for lay followers, which includes celibacy for that 24-hour period. And of course, all of these are taken on the basis of refuge. And then there's the five pratimoksha ethical codes for monastics. The precepts for novice nuns and novice monks, either 10 or 36 in the Tibetan tradition, and the precepts for training nuns, which some of our nuns have now, and the precepts of full ordination. Okay, so I think Venerable covered that section really well. But then we move on to talk about some of the Vinaya schools, and some of you may not be aware of this kind of information. The three extant Vinaya lineages stem from the original 18 schools of early Buddhism. So, there we go. Okay, so this is the other tanka that I thought people online especially might like to see. It's on the other side of the altar in the Posada room in the Buddha hall. And this is Upali, who was the foremost monk in ethical conduct. So we have these two representations. We call this the Posada room because this is primarily where we do our bi-monthly confession and restoration of our precepts, as well as other things like teachings, or we use it however we need to use it, but principally it's for doing our Posada. And so we have things in here that remind us of the value of monastic ethical conduct in particular, like the 16 arhats. They made very strong prayers specifically to be helpful in supporting the Sangha. I remember how clear and how firm Venerable was when she taught this whole section on Sangha, talking about ethical conduct. I found for myself I was getting a little uncomfortable because I thought, but Venerable, lots of people online aren't monastics. But Venerable is so, I'm guessing, this is my guess, Venerable is so certain of the value of the monastic life. I mean, that's why she's an abbess, right? That's why she started a monastery. And that's not to take anything away from lay practitioners, not at all. But it's quite amazing in this day and age to have a teacher, a female Western teacher, who values monastic life so much, because in a lot of traditions, there are more and more lay people who don't see the value in monastic life and the potential for monastics to sincerely preserve and spread the Buddha Dharma. So we're very fortunate to have such a teacher. Okay, so there are these three Vinaya traditions today. The Theravada, found predominantly in South and Southeast Asia, that came from Sri Lanka, the lineage brought to Sri Lanka by Ashoka's daughter in the 3rd century. And that's where we find the Pali literature. I thought this was interesting. I hadn't really put this in my mind before, but they rely on authoritative commentaries by Buddhaghosa, and others as well, but Buddhaghosa. So whenever someone quoted, it was you, you quoted Buddhaghosa this morning. Yeah, okay. And then the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya lineage, which was translated into Chinese in the 4th century. So it's interesting to note that Buddhism went to China before it went to Tibet, just as a note. It was translated into Chinese in around 410, 412 by Buddha Yashas. And in 709, the emperor decreed that it was to be the only Vinaya followed in China, the Dharmaguptaka. But there were 5 important Vinaya commentaries that were translated into Chinese, and many further commentaries have been written in Chinese. And we hear this name often, Daoxuan. Am I saying it correctly? Daoxuan? He was a 6th, 7th century prolific commentator on the Vinaya. And so his 3 books of Nanshan and other Vinaya materials have been studied up to the present. And what's amazing about this Vinaya lineage, which we hold here, is that there are 5 other Vinaya lineages in the Chinese canon, so they can refer to those when something is not clear in the Dharmaguptaka. That shows a very broad and open mind, doesn't it? So occasionally when we're reading Vinaya literature, we'll see in the so-and-so Vinaya lineage, this is spelled out this way. So it gives a little more clarity to what we're studying. And then the Mula Sabhasta Vada Vinaya is followed in Tibet, Mongolia, and the Himalayan regions, such as Bhutan, one of our participants has just come back from that full ordination. We'll hear about that tomorrow. Yeah. Okay. So then we come to a section called The Benefits of Practicing the Pratimoksha Ethical Code. And this chapter begins with a statement. Not that statement, but anyway. Oh. The statement is, contentment is an internal feeling that arises when craving is absent. I found that to be a very powerful reminder. Contentment is an internal feeling that arises when craving is absent. Can you relate to that? Can you think about feelings that you've experienced? Moments of contentment when craving was just wasn't there? So I have a question for you. How has practicing, I was going to say the Vinaya, but to include our lay friends as well, how has practicing holding ethical codes helped you to create contentment in your life? So whether it's the lay vows or the bodhisattva vows, maybe the tantric vows, the monastic vows, how has that helped you create contentment in your life?
I mean, I guess for one, I'm not trying to figure out what to do with my life. That's brought a lot of contentment because I spent a lot of years trying to figure that out. And yeah.
Yeah.
By holding the precepts, there's a calmness. There's no need to be involved as a lay practitioner. I'm content not involved being involved. I'm content not reaching out. I'm content that the precepts really help that, that sense of this inner calm, regardless of what's going on around, and then the container that those precepts allow the mind to rest with.
Are you talking principally there about the lay precepts?
Yeah, I find that's really helpful. They're extremely helpful. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because often when I think about contentment and craving, I'm thinking about material things, but for me, I see that there's a certain contentment in terms of basically who I am and what I'm doing and what I've done. And so, I can see that some of those times that I really regret an action in kind of a unhealthy guilt sort of way, it's like, oh, I almost crave for a world where I didn't do it. Like I can see there's an afflicted mind there that has that like, oh, I want to forget that I did this. I want no one to know that I did this. So when I'm abiding by my precepts, I have that clear understanding of what I'm doing. I'm happy with myself. I can look back at what I did yesterday and I'm pretty happy with that too. And yes, mistakes happen, but they're not as big and bad as they used to be. Mm-hmm. And I have that clarity of like, okay, I have methods of purifying this, or I can really look and see, well, what was the affliction? What were the conditions that led to breaking that precept, and how can I do it differently next time? Mm-hmm. So for me, there's like a real contentment with myself because of it.
I wonder what the relationship is between contentment and self-confidence. Mm-hmm. When you were speaking, it sounded a lot like how Venerable talks about when we live by our values. There's naturally this self-confidence that comes because there's not that dissonance between who we want to be, how we want to live, and the values, and then the mistakes we make. Yeah.
it's the feeling of this harmony of being in alignment with what you just said.
Harmony and alliance with your values.
With one's own values.
Uh-huh.
If they are virtuous ones.
Yes. Venerable Gyatso.
So glad that we don't handle money, because when you go into town, you see billboards and advertisements everywhere just pulling your attention here and there. Buy this, get that, this will make you happy. And just to hold that precept and not have to worry about any of that stuff, I don't need to even think about it. I can just be content with what I have and where I am right now.
Uh-huh. That's good. Yeah. In my own life, I have a very generous sister who periodically sends me emails about, hey, these slippers are on sale. Do you need slippers? And I take stock of my slippers and I can write back with confidence and say, you know, my slipper supply is really good right now, but thanks all the same. It's a kind of contentment of like, I don't need all that, but I appreciate her generosity all the same. Yeah. Venerable Lamsa.
Online, someone says precepts provide an anchor to rest in contentment, even if for a few moments.
Yeah.
And then personally, with the five lay precepts, just abandoning intoxicants was a huge source of contentment, where just usually the environments where we drink, even if it's just in the evening with family, around watching TV, or it's how you relax. It's like the mind isn't content with how we are. We need something else to feel better, to relax more. Like it, where we are, what we're doing isn't enough. So it's like just extract myself from that was a huge turning point in contentment, but also direction to here. And then the restrictions around how we handle resources, around how we eat, when we eat, what we can eat, just really narrowing the options, and to be learned to be content with what is offered and grateful. And the mind that always wants something different, it becomes very loud when what we receive we don't like. And it's like, oh, okay, that's the mind to be abandoned. And progressively it's been slowly changing, and it's so much nicer than the mind always looking for something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, accepting food without attachment or complaint.
What I'm noticing in my own mind is that the longer I keep the precepts and keep learning about them, there's this ongoing education, this refinement of how to use our body and speech in ways that are, you know, beneficial. And then I look at people like Venerable Master Wu Yin and Venerable Chödrön and Venerable Kadro, who have been living the precepts for decades, and how their refinement in how they move through space and how they interact with people and use their speech. That's very, very inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's not very directly to the topic in the sense of ethical conduct, but it might bridge to tomorrow's topic about Bhutan, because many of us might know that Bhutan has kind of coined this term of cross-national happiness. And when I was now in Bhutan, I actually came to know that the fourth king, who came up with all of that campaign, has actually not talked about cross-national happiness. He has talked about cross-national contentment.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. And then only, you know, his strategic advisors and Western people and whatnot, convinced him that will not sell. And that, you know, and that they chose cross-national happiness, which really, maybe it's true, you know, it wouldn't have necessarily worked with cross-national contentment. Uh-huh. But if we think now in our context about this, how much actually stronger and what a much more profounder message that is, cross-national contentment over cross-national happiness.
Yeah, I think a lot of people haven't taken the time to compare the kind of happiness that we get with external sources as opposed to the happiness or the contentment, the well-being that one experiences through ethical conduct. And maybe it's not some people's cup of tea, but I know I'd much rather prefer that contentment within my own mind. It's that peacefulness is what I'm wanting more of. Yeah, not so much the excitement. Well, it depends on the day, but for the most part, yeah, that contentment's really wonderful. I had an experience Wednesday night when I left the Spokane class. It just caught me by surprise. I think it's really good for us to think about what kind of contentment we have in our life so that we appreciate it. But I noticed, because it was the last class for the year with the monastics, we received a lot of appreciation, which should be shared with all the people who've been facilitating throughout the year. And it was very heartwarming. But when I walked out, I felt so clean, like, oh, I can just take in that appreciation and I don't want to cling to it. There's no attachment. It's just like, it just felt really clean. It was different. That's why I noticed it. It's like, oh, okay. You know, anyway. Okay. Back up one more, please. So as we practice releasing our craving, thank you for your participation there. As we practice releasing our craving and being satisfied with the present situation, contentment naturally arises. From our own experience, we learn that contentment comes not from having all our desires fulfilled, but from freeing ourselves from being under the control of those desires. So if any of you are looking for good reading material during the course, How to Practice the Dharma by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, teaching how to overcome attachment, specifically to the eight worldly concerns, is a beautiful book you can read again and again and again. Okay. In this section, Venerable and His Holiness also talk about how practicing the Vinaya helps us to develop fortitude, such as practicing with the advice that monastics, I don't know where this comes in our monastic training, maybe you can help me remember, but you know, we have this ascetic practice, if others are angry with you, do not react with anger, but with fortitude. Where does that come from? Is that in, anyway, maybe you can think. If others hit you, do not attack them back. If others criticize you, do not criticize them in return. If others embarrass or insult you, do not respond by embarrassing or insulting them. Yeah. So that's another powerful thought to work with in this period of time where we're not only in winter retreat, but we're also in our Varsa period, the monastic Varsa. Okay, now the next slide. So in this section, Venerable and His Holiness are talking about how the monastic precepts may have been established in ancient Indian culture, you know, an agrarian society where it was difficult to find cloth, women were cloistered in their homes, and going on alms round was societally acceptable and even seen as virtuous. But contemporary society is very different where we find ourselves now. There are cars, digital devices, and the internet, items that are not regulated in the Vinaya. Women are educated, many families have only one parent, and people work long hours and have limited free time. Some monastics choose to keep the precepts exactly as written in the Vinaya, and that is commendable. However, because of the changes in society, I believe the way to keep some of the precepts needs to be adjusted. We must look at the Buddha's intention in establishing each precept. What mental state is that precept designed to subdue? And if societal conditions are not suitable to keep a particular precept literally, how can we implement the meaning of the precept in our lives? So I just thought to share on the next slide, in the Vinaya training that we just recently completed, we had these precepts analysis templates where we would take, for the Bhikshunis, 348, well, we didn't take all of them, but some of the 348 precepts that we hold, and also some of them we share with the Bhikshus, some of them are unique to Bhikshunis, some are unique to Bhikshus, but in different groups, we looked at these precepts in accordance to these different categories, like who was involved in the precept, where did it happen, what was the incident, what was the internal cause of the transgression, like really trying to guess what was happening in the minds of the people who were the naughty monks or nuns that instigated the precept. Now it's very interesting to try to guess, because often it's not spelled out in the precepts, and yet we're trying to understand them. The external conditions and the impact after the transgression occurred, and then the Buddha's considerations. Also the characteristics of the precepts and exceptions. We find exceptions in a lot of them. And then once we had looked at a precept according to these characteristics, then we tried to summarize it, like with summarizing the origin story and noticing how did the Buddha teach his disciples and how did he respond to the situation and what were his main concerns? Because that's what's really going to help us learn how to apply that precept in our daily life in this modern age where things are very different. We don't have to worry about throwing chamber pot contents over the wall, you know, and things like that. So how do we really understand the essence of our precepts, which was like a eureka moment, I think, for many of us. Because often precepts are taught in a very dry, I don't know, what would you call it? Kind of an orderly fashion.
Legalistic
manner. But this was anything but legalistic. And this is the way Vinaya Master Wu Yin holds them, as well as our own abbess, Venerable Chodron. So we had just a wonderful time, I think. I think most everyone felt very uplifted, even though we were tired. We felt very uplifted in having the opportunity to think about the precepts in this way. And I was trying to think if there was a way we could apply these to the lay precepts. I haven't quite thought of something yet, but I'll bet there's something, some way that also, I mean, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, those are pretty standard no matter what time, what period of time we're living in. Okay, and then the other thing, the next slide, the other thing that really stood out to me from that Vinaya training in a new way, I had seen it before, the Buddha gave these 10 benefits. He taught 10 advantages every time he taught a precept. So every time there was an opportunity to present a precept, he predicated, is that the right word? He preceded... He prefaced it with these 10 benefits. And what I came to see, let me know what your experience was, what I came to see and feel from this process, and also the way we were working with the precepts, was the incredible care and consideration that the Buddha had for his followers in general. Monastics, yes, but his followers in general. So I thought this might be interesting to people online who, unless you've read Choosing with Simplicity, you may not have come across this. So the first three reasons are to promote harmony within the Sangha. So these precepts help to direct the monastics to know what to do, what not to do. It also helps to foster peace and happiness among the monastics so that we all kind of have this shared reality of what we're doing, living together. And to protect the monastics, I think primarily from criticism from the lay people. You know, and that also protects the lay people, but, you know, in having a precept, it can protect the lay people, but it also protects the monastics. Then the next two advantages of the precepts help to transform society, to inspire those who have no faith in the Dharma by observing monastics living within precepts. And there's that beautiful story, I don't remember the names of the people involved, but there's the beautiful story of the monk who was walking along and someone saw him, maybe you can fill in the blanks, Ashvajit was the monk. Shariputra saw him walking in the distance and noticed his beautiful countenance. And just by that alone, you know, probably saw a bit of a glow or an energy around him. Just by that alone, he went to him and said, "Tell me who your teacher is and what he teaches." So, you know, all of us as practitioners of the Dharma, the more we embody the Dharma ourselves, the more we become a walking advertisement for Buddhism in the best sense of that term, you know, that we're sharing that with people. People notice that. So it inspires those who have no faith in the Dharma. I remember for myself, after I started getting involved with Tibetan Buddhism, one of my friends said, "What are you doing lately? You're changing. You're not as angry as you used to be." Yeah, it works. And then the second advantage for transforming society is to advance the practice of those who already have faith. So we're encouraging people who already are involved with Buddhism. And then the last four are to help us to bring about our own individual liberation. You know, to restrain those parts of us that are hard to restrain, restrain the rest of, and to stabilize those who have a sense of integrity. We want to live within a sense of integrity. I think most of us have that desire, but it's difficult. And so these precepts are like guardrails. And then to eliminate our present defilements and to prevent defilements from arising in the future. So these are what are going to really help us bring about our own individual liberation. And then all of those nine bring about the tenth, which is the ultimate purpose, which is to preserve and spread the Buddha Dharma so that the Dharma can be forever sustained, is what it says. Okay, so that section about looking at the, what was it? The benefits of practicing the Pratimoksha ethical code, whether we're looking at it in terms of our five lay precepts or our 10 monastic precepts or our, how many, 292 Shiksamana precepts? 392, 350 trainings, not precepts, trainings, okay. 250 precepts for the bhikshus, 348 for the bhikshunis. So if you need some inspiration during the retreat, I would suggest this section, looking at the benefits. Because as we've seen, when we understand the benefits, we're more likely to really put our energy, develop aspiration. That's one way. Yeah, when we understand the benefits, that develops our aspiration. That brings about the ability to put in the joyous effort and bring about the result. Okay, so I just want to close with one final question. And our winter retreat will focus on white Tara and the four immeasurables. So I'm curious, what specific thoughts or ideas do you have for working with the afflictions and negative actions in retreat? As thinking about the higher training and ethical conduct. So we're focusing on a deity. We're focusing on the four immeasurables. But have you, I'm just curious, I know I want to give more thought to how I'm going to actually work with the afflictions and negative actions in retreat. So I'm curious, have you given that some thought?
Mm-hmm. So I've been thinking about the four immeasurables, you know, themselves as cultivating a positive mental state, and we say that positive mental states and negative mental states cannot abide in the mind at the same time. So if I'm putting effort into, for instance, growing my compassion, growing my love, hopefully then I'll be able to see that manifest, so that if I see, malice or hatred arise in my mind throughout the retreat, you know, will thoughts of love and compassion be easier to come up? You know, will I think of it quicker? So that's one of the ways I'm just thinking about it, that naturally if I'm practicing love and compassion more, those antidotes then should be stronger and more available to me. So I hope to see that work out. Mm-hmm.
And just hearing you say that reminds me of the near enemies and the far enemies of the four immeasurables.
For me at retreat time, the most helpful situation around it is that we're in silence, so that's easier to manage my mind. And also, since I'm not so pulled in so many different directions, I can focus my attention and really work with my mindfulness and introspective awareness, because if I'm practicing that, then I will identify when my mind starts getting off track very quickly and early on, and then it's easier to turn that. So that's the most help during retreat for me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What about others?
When we look at the four immeasurables, what I would really like to concentrate in this upcoming retreat is about equanimity. And so at times I can be really quickly and strongly opinionated. And so, which is of course really the opposite of equanimity. And so I really hope to bring that to the forefront of my attention and have to a very close look at it and hopefully decrease it under the retreat circumstances.
That's a really good point, that equanimity is intentionally lessening our attachment and aversion and really coming to the middle of a more equanimous state with other people in particular. But yeah, thank you.
One of the things I want to look at is really deepening and strengthening my conviction in the Buddhist worldview, because I think expanding the perspective is so helpful, because so many of the afflictions arise in relationship to this life and to the worldly concerns, and to just keep expanding my mind to think of these are sentient beings caught in samsara, undergoing these various levels of dukkha, creating causes for their own suffering, you know, and just to really think about people in a more broad, expansive way to lessen the afflictions.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, the lay people didn't have a chance to see these questions ahead of time to give some thought. But if you have any thoughts about this, please speak up. Others?
I think the purification practice is probably what I focus on the most. It's interesting coming to a certain place. We've all done a lot of purification practice. We do it, most of us, every day. But there's sort of sometimes there's a point where you go, oh my God, there's a whole level of subtlety about what could be purified, what should be purified, what has and what has not been purified. That is, it's interesting. So the gentleness of Tara, white Tara, and the wisdom that comes with white Tara as a purification, especially in terms of, you know, we haven't talked about this very much, but the whole thinking behind, or one of the thinkings behind this, is that we're also dedicating our merit for the long life of His Holiness, for the long life of Venerable Children, for the long life of Geshe Thapke, and for the long life of Venerable Sangye Kadro, not just our own. And so in that regard, I mean, what makes the long life of a teacher? The practice of the student. The practice and the faith, confidence of the student in following the teacher's instruction. So any amount of tuning up those things that can also contribute to that great benefit to these great beings living longer and longer and longer in teaching is also kind of a part of my motivation.
Yeah. It's interesting. I wonder how many people think of white Tara as a purification practice. I think probably the stronger association is her ability to lead to long life.
Yeah, but why do we get long life? Purification. Right?
What are the causes of creating long life? Is purifying, purifying, purifying. I mean, and it's even in instruction, especially purifying all those actions that might result in an untimely death or an iad, separation from mental and physical capacity to practice the Dharma in this life. Mm-hmm. So you know, the power of using the purification to keep the intention to what we're doing while we have the time to do it, I think is, I mean, at least for me at this point in my life, is really important. Mm-hmm. Work on getting over wasting time, like the world condition.
The what? What do you mean?
Well, the distraction. I mean, it isn't. There's a. I have a. Maybe we probably all have gone through this. I have a certain sense of responsibility that the world that I thought I had grown up in has become something else. I don't know. And I have great concern about that in lots and lots and lots of areas. At the same, and so I'm still following more than I probably should. So
in
at
terms
this,
of news and what's happening.
Yeah, turning in the news, what's going on today? Oh my gosh, these people are being harmed, la la la. So that is extremely, I think, important to continue to fuel my practice, but it's also very easy to get distracted into that. Mm-hmm. We all have the karma to have been born now. This isn't just what's happening to the people who are getting picked up by ICE. It's not just happening to the ICE people who are doing that or the people who are giving the orders. We all have this karma. So to have the commitment to really try to purify to whatever level and dedicate that for the long life of my teachers, who can bring a lot of benefit to those people, and me too, but not much at this point right now, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. so there's a whole, anyway, that's part of the purification.
Yeah. Good, thank you. Yeah. Others? This is lovely. This is inspiring. We can all take inspiration from sharing with each other how we're thinking about it. Okay. So, ethical, higher training of ethical conduct. Let's dedicate.